He was only 32 years old when he died, but in his short life, Alexander the Great reshaped the ancient world, and his influence still reaches into the modern world. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Philip Freeman is a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah and author of the new biography, Alexander the Great. Today, we'll talk about Alexander's upbringing and what shaped him. We'll talk about his leadership and remarkable ability to strategize and defeat the toughest armies of his day. When he began his rule at age 19, he quickly established control over Greece, but that was not nearly enough for him. He invaded the Persian Empire, and his conquests took him to Egypt, Pakistan, and even India. We'll also talk about his intellectual and personal lives, and most importantly, find out how we are all touched by his influence even today. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. He took the crown at age 19, and he died when he was only 32 years old. But in that short time as king of Macedonia, Alexander the Great touched millions of lives and reshaped the ancient world. His military tactics have been studied now for centuries, and his influence is still felt in many ways today. With me right now is Philip Freeman. He is Quali Professor of Classics at Luther College in Decorah, and he's author of the new biography, Alexander the Great. Philip, thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alexander was the son of Philip II. He was king of Macedonia, and you start your book with the day that Alexander was born. Tell me what Philip II was doing on that day.
Well, on that day, Philip was up in what's now northern Greece, besieging a city, which he did quite a bit. And on this day, there was a messenger that left the Olympic Games and rode all the way up to northern Greece and told Philip the news that his son was born. But there were two other messengers that day that came in and gave news about some conquests of his at a place to the west, and then also that his horse had just won the Olympic Games. So Philip was very excited about all three of this, three of these pieces of news.
But particularly the horse.
No, the horse. The horse was his favorite, yes, that he had actually won, sponsored a horse that won the Olympic Games.
So Alexander's birth was not at least the biggest thing to happen in his father's life, although as time went on, tales were certainly told of his conception and birth being quite the event.
Yes, absolutely. In the ancient world, whenever you have a hero, there are always tales that spring up about his conception. Alexander's mother, Olympias, was from a country called Epirus, which is basically modern-day Albania. And she was this foreign, sort of exotic princess in the court of Philip. And stories came out that that she liked to sleep with snakes, and that a lightning bolt from Zeus had gotten her pregnant. So all sorts of stories came up about the birth of Alexander. But I think probably he was Philip's son.
And even at the time, though, there were some supernatural stories told about the family. I mean, the family, Philip himself was supposed to have been descended from Hercules.
Oh, yes. The Macedonian court, all the Macedonian kings claimed that they were originally from Argos in southern Greece and that their ancestor was Hercules. And again, this was a very common thing. Pretty much anybody who was a king in the ancient world claimed that he had a god for an ancestor.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the upbringing of Alexander, because, of course, the supernatural events that surrounded his birth later really didn't take place. He was a fairly normal baby born to a royal family, and he was not a spoiled prince. How was he brought up?
Well, he was brought up by two tutors, one of whom was very harsh. He made Alexander march all night and made him skip dinner and just really put him through the ringer as far as physical activities. Alexander was brought up learning how to fight, learning how to throw a spear, learning how to use a bow and arrow. So it was not a pampered upbringing at all. But he was also very well educated by probably the best teacher anybody could imagine.
And who was that teacher?
Well, that was Aristotle, of course, the philosopher Aristotle, who was then a fairly young man, and he was looking for a job. And Philip brought him up to Macedonia, and he became Alexander's tutor. He taught Alexander and several of the royal young men of the court. And so for about 3 or 4 years, Aristotle drilled Alexander on every possible subject you could imagine, medicine, literature, meteorology. Aristotle was a polymath. He was an insatiably curious man. And so he passed that curiosity on to Alexander, and the curiosity lasted the rest of Alexander's life.
And Alexander did seem to have some real aptitude when it came to his studies.
Oh, he did. He was a brilliant student. He absolutely loved the Greek poet Homer. He carried a copy of the Iliad with him. Even when he was out in the middle of Afghanistan fighting wars, he always had his Iliad with him. He would read it at night. Alexander was a gifted musician. We know that. He was very good at playing the harp. He was an extremely good student.
So we know that he was a very good student, but what other signs were there that we know of when he was a young man that led people to believe that they could expect great things of him?
Well, I think the best story comes when Alexander was 12 years old, and he was up in a place called Dion, which is just north of Mount Olympus. It's a beautiful place. You can see the snows of Mount Olympus right above you. And there was a big horse trading festival there, and a horse trader had brought this magnificent black stallion, and he wanted to sell it to King Philip, and King Philip appreciated a good horse, but he saw this horse and it was too wild. It really couldn't be controlled.
And the man wanted to sell him the horse for a lot of money.
Oh, for an awful lot of money. And Philip had the money. He probably could have done it, but he said, no way, the horse is untamable. I don't want it. But young Alexander, 12-year-old Alexander, comes up and he says, Father, I can tame that horse. And Philip says, how dare you? You know, there's no way you can do that. And Alexander says, yes, I can. So Philip says, okay, do it. And so Alexander had used his brain, and he noticed something about Bucephalus, about this magnificent animal, that the horse was scared of its shadow. And so he took the reins of Bucephalus and pointed his head into the sun so that he couldn't see a shadow. He stroked the horse, calmed him down for a few minutes, and then jumped up on his back and took off across the plains and rode back again to his father to great applause. And Philip greets Alexander, and he says, my son, you have to find a bigger kingdom. Macedonia is just not going to be good enough for you.
Speaking of Macedonia not being a big enough place, Philip obviously felt that as well. And in his rule, he was very interested in conquering other lands. What was his rule like?
Well, Philip started also as a young man in Macedonia. Macedonia is in northern Greece. It's a beautiful, huge valley, mountainous, ringed by mountains, to the west of Thessaloniki, which shows up in the New Testament, actually. But it's an area that was, in Philip's day, was besieged by just about everybody. But Philip built it up into a great kingdom, and he did it by using military means and innovation that nobody else had thought of. He was the first general to really use a professional engineering corps as part of his army. And he also developed this way of fighting against the heavily armed Greek infantry, and the infantry was called hoplites. They were practically unbeatable. Anybody who's seen the movie 300 with the Spartans at Thermopylae, those are hoplites, and they are very, very tough. And the hoplites carried spears that were about 8 to 10 feet long, and Philip said, you know what? I'm going to make a spear that's 18 feet long. And so the spear could outreach the hoplites. So Philip does this. It takes tremendous training for an army to use spears that are 18 feet long. It's very easy to get, you know, mixed up with each other. But Philip did it. And he turned his army into an unstoppable machine that conquered all of Greece and all the way up into the Balkans.
There's a part in the book where you talk about how Alexander was watching as his father conquered all of these lands. And of course, he didn't see a lot of his dad. His dad was away at war most of the time. And even when he was home, it wasn't like he was taking care of him on a day-to-day basis. So Alexander was watching from afar, and he seemed to be chomping at the bit to get out there himself.
Oh, absolutely. And Philip did not quite trust Alexander, I think, but he admired Alexander's ability, and Alexander was left at home to take care of things or to read Homer or something while Philip was out conquering, and Alexander very much wanted to be out there. So when Philip made him regent for a campaign while Philip was off doing something, Alexander took off at the age of 16, beat back some enemies, and founded a city and named it after himself, and Philip was not happy about this.
And he started naming things after himself quite young. That continued
absolutely.
On for a very long time. Well, Alexander was the clear heir to the throne of Philip. At least it seemed so to everyone. But Philip changed his mind about that at one point. What happened?
He did. Alexander was about 18, 19 years old, and he started to get a lot of pressure from some of the Macedonian nobles. They said, Philip, you're still young. You're in your early 40s. You can have another son. Marry a Macedonian wife, not some foreign barbarian from Epirus, and give us a real Macedonian heir. So Philip listened to this, and he sent Alexander's mother, Olympias, away, and Alexander, too, banished them both. And he later came to regret this, just a few months later, and called Alexander back and made him heir again.
Why did he bring him back? Why was there that change of heart?
I think Philip realized that Philip right then was already planning to invade the Persian Empire in what's modern-day Turkey. And he realized he needed Alexander, I think, was basically it. He didn't quite trust him, but he needed him. So he was going to leave Alexander there at home while he and his army took off against Persia. So I think that's probably why he changed his mind.
Well, Philip's reign did not last for much longer. What happened to Philip?
Well, Philip, as I said, was planning to invade the Persian Empire, this vast empire, largest ever it existed. And he threw a big party. This is a place called Vergina, which is, again, not too far from Mount Olympus. But Philip became convinced that everybody loved him and that he was in absolutely no danger. So he sent away his bodyguards, and he marches into the theater one morning with Alexander by his side. And wouldn't you know it, there's this young man named Pausanias, who is a jilted lover of Philip, who runs up and stabs him through the heart and kills him. And Philip bleeds to death there in the theater, and the last thing he sees are the eyes of his son Alexander staring down at him.
And that is the beginning of Alexander's reign. And we're going to talk a great deal more about Alexander's reign as king and his conquests in just a moment. But we're going to have to take a short break right now. My guest today is Philip Freeman. He's a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah. And his most recent book is called Alexander the Great. And it's a complete biography, a modern biography of Alexander the Great. We will continue our conversation about Alexander's rule as king of Macedonia and the conquests he made into the Persian Empire and beyond in just a few minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The influences of Alexander the Great are still being felt today. We'll find out how later on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about Alexander the Great. Philip Freeman is a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah, and he's just written a new biography of Alexander the Great that explores his upbringing, his life, his conquests, and also his legacy. And we'll talk more about that as the hour goes on. But Philip, when we left for the break, Alexander's father, Philip II, had just been killed, and that left the throne of Macedonia to Alexander. What did Alexander have to do at that point? It wasn't as simple as just inheriting the crown. What did he have to do at that point to take the throne and maintain his rule?
Well, the first thing he had to do was convince the Macedonian army that he was the right guy. The Macedonian kings were absolute rulers, in a sense, but they really needed the army's support. So Alexander got up, this young 19, 20-year-old man gets up and convinces them that he's the right guy to lead this kingdom. And then he has to fight back all of the people who are plotting against him, the Athenians. He's got enemies all over the place. So he has to establish his borders. A lot of the tribes in the northern Balkans are going to revolt. So he has to convince everybody that he is every bit as tough as his father, Philip.
And how does he do that?
Well, he goes in. Well, the first thing he does is, like I said, he gets the support of the army. And then he goes up and he goes all the way to the Danube River and secures his borders in what's now modern-day Romania. And then he marches back down because he hears that the Greeks are rebelling against him. The Greeks hated him. They always hated him. And especially the people of the town of Thebes, north of Athens. And so he shows up at Thebes when everybody thought he'd already been killed. And he destroys the city of Thebes, absolutely sacks it. He kills most of the men. He sells the women and children into slavery, pretty standard procedure in those days. And he convinces the Greeks that they better behave.
And that seems to cement his leadership over Greece and obviously in Macedonia as well. But he wasn't satisfied with that. Many people wanted him to, at that point, to cement his rule, to stay on the throne, to get married and sire an heir. But he didn't want to do that, did he?
No, it would have been the practical thing to do. Find a nice girl, get married, have a few sons, solidify the empire. Alexander wanted none of that. He absolutely loved challenge. He loved adventure. So he continues his father Philip's plans to invade the Persian Empire. He sets off that spring, and he crosses into Asia. In the first place he goes to is the ancient city of Troy, because he's such a fan of Homer. He can't help but go to Troy first. And he takes off his clothes, runs naked around the city, does all sorts of fun things there. And then he's looking for the Persians. He wants a fight. He wants to face these guys. And he finally finds them at a place called the Granicus River, which is not too far from Istanbul.
And when he was in Troy, we need to talk about his devotion to the gods, because he was a very religious man, and he made his sacrifices to the gods on a daily basis. When he was in Troy, he also gave up his armor. What did he do?
Well, he traded his armor. Troy had been visited by people for a long time, but it was really a pretty sleepy tourist spot. Alexander shows up there, and the priests there say, "Wow, look, we've got the armor of Achilles, and the shield of Achilles." And Alexander says, "I want that." So he takes it. Who's going to say no to Alexander? And then he really sees himself as an Achilles figure, somebody who is a half god, half man, a great warrior destined for wonderful things.
And as you mentioned, he's reading Homer's Iliad constantly, so this is something very, very present in his mind. Before we get to his invasion of the Persian Empire, we have Eric on the line from Ankeny. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I remember hearing in my undergrad days that the day that Alexander the Great was born, the temple to Diana or Artemis in Ephesus burned down. Is that true?
Yes, it is. The temple in Ephesus, the Romans called her Diana, the Greeks called her Artemis, it did burn down on that same day. And this was seen as a sign that there had been a tremendous event take place, the birth of Alexander. But truly, the temple of Ephesus was quite ready to burn down, and the story came out later. It was probably some crazy guy who had set it on fire, but Alexander was certainly not above using propaganda like that.
And you said it burned down many times.
Yeah, it burned down more than once. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this happened all the time in temples in the ancient world.
Well, Eric, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call. So let's talk about, as Alexander is getting ready to enter the Persian Empire, give us a picture of what the Persian Empire was like and the odds for Alexander and his army, because this didn't look like a smart move.
Oh, no, it was an absolutely crazy thing to do. If you look at a map of the ancient world, Macedonia and Greece are pretty small, but the Persian Empire stretched all the way from modern-day Turkey down to Egypt, into Iraq and Syria and into the heartland of the empire in Iran, and then went all the way over into modern Pakistan and India and up into Uzbekistan and Afghanistan. It was the largest empire the world had ever known, and it was very well organized and very tough.
And what did Alexander's army look like at this point?
Well, they were a whole bunch of very well-armed infantry with their long sarissa spears, and he had cavalry contingents. He was very good at using horsemen, and he had a number of auxiliary forces from different tribes, mostly from the Balkans, from Thrace and other places. Plus, he had the Athenian navy following him along the coast. He needed the ships for supplies and other things.
But he didn't have a lot of money. He hadn't been paying his soldiers.
No, that was a problem. If he had thought about this carefully, any other person would have waited a while, saved up money. Alexander goes off and invades Persia without any money to pay his soldiers. He desperately needs a victory in order to both cement his, to impress people, and to get some money. He needs to conquer some rich city so that he can pay his soldiers.
So on the Persian side, they know that Alexander and his army is coming, but they can't be taking this too seriously.
They're not. They think, this is just some kid, some boy king. Let him invade. Let him cross into Troy. Let him get a few hundred miles into Turkey, into Asia Minor, and then we'll wipe him out and go back and have dinner.
So really, they were leading him into a trap.
Oh, they were. They were, and when he gets to the Granicus River, it's a river that's really not that big, but it's smooth on one side and has a steep bank on the other side, and the Persians are waiting on the other side on top of this steep bank so that Alexander's men not only have to cross the river under fire, but they have to somehow climb up this bank to attack the Persians, which would just be a crazy thing for anybody to do, but Alexander does it.
When he meets the Persian army, what happens?
Well, the Persians are waiting across the Granicus River, and Alexander charges them. He does it so fast that they really didn't know what to expect, but it's not an easy fight. A lot of his men are killed trying to get up that bank. Alexander himself almost gets killed. It's a very tough fight. There's a Persian who has his sword raised right behind Alexander, ready to cut off his head, when one of Alexander's men named Clytus, Black Clytus, comes up and sticks a spear right through the Persian, saves Alexander's life. If that Persian had killed Alexander the Great, it would have been a very different world. And I would have been out of a job teaching Greek, probably. But he is saved, and he wins the battle, just barely, but he does win the battle. And the Persians withdraw.
After that victory, what does that mean for his army? What's next?
Well, it's a great morale boost for them. They think, wow, we've beaten the Persians. This is wonderful. And then they go down and they start taking over some of the cities, what's now along the coast of Turkey, along the Aegean. Cities like Sardis, Ephesus, and cities that have money, cities that have treasuries. And so Alexander appropriates the treasuries. He's finally able to pay his soldiers. It's not a lot of money, but it's enough. He's able to fund his army operations, but still he's really operating on a shoestring to a great extent for the next year or so.
As he is moving through these places and taking over cities, what is his approach? I mean, you mentioned when he crossed the Danube, I mean, basically they destroyed everything they saw and they killed everyone that they could. But this is not the approach he's taking as he invades the Persian Empire.
Right. Alexander realizes that in order for him to take over at least a part of this empire, he's going to have to do it smartly. He's going to have to be intelligent about it. And what he does is he appoints a Persian or a local governor to run things, often the same person who was doing it before, but he also appoints a military garrison run by a loyal Macedonian officer to keep an eye on things. He doesn't disturb things. The people still keep their land, their houses, they worship the same gods, they pay taxes, but now they pay them to Alexander instead of to the Persians.
So he basically just leaves everything intact.
Right, he does, because the Persians had a really good system, and Alexander realized that, so he said, why should I disturb this? I'm just going to take it over.
And that seems, obviously, that worked very well for him in many ways, but it seems precarious.
Well, it was. A lot of his Macedonian officers didn't like this. They wanted to sack the cities, get all the money they could, and go home. But Alexander has a greater vision, I think. He really does want to expand the Macedonian Empire into Asia. And so he realizes he has to be very careful about this.
As he's moving along and continuing this campaign, what are the people around him thinking and doing. Is there solidarity among his ranks?
Well, not really. He has a lot of old officers of his father, Philip, who are he really needed. He couldn't get rid of them, but you know, he's a young man. He's 20, 21 years old now. He really hates to have all of these 50 and 60-year-old generals of his father hanging around, but he needs them. And so he's always working to establish himself, to increase his power. And there's always dissension. A lot of the older officers want to stop. They think, you know, as soon as we conquer the Aegean coast of Asia Minor, that's enough. We don't need to, you know, take any more risks. But Alexander keeps pushing them farther and farther inland.
Many of us have heard the story of the Gordian Knot, the legend, really, of the Gordian Knot, which, of course, Alexander himself had heard about and actually encountered the Gordian Knot on his travels. Tell me about that.
Well, the Gordian Knot was in a place called Gordian, in the center of what's now Turkey, and it was an impossible knot that was woven around the yoke of a cart. And the story was that whoever could untie the Gordian Knot would conquer all of Asia. So Alexander goes up and he looks at it. He crawls underneath. He very carefully examines it. And it takes a long time. And by now there's a lot of people standing around. Alexander's starting to get nervous. What if I can't untie this? And so he pulls out his sword and just cuts the thing in half. And he says, it doesn't matter how I undo it, as long as I undo it. And I think that's just a great example. Whether the story is true or not, I don't know. I like to believe it is, because I think it really shows how Alexander worked, how his mind worked.
What was life like for Alexander at this point? He's moving with his army, camping with his army. This doesn't sound pleasant to me, but he was having a fairly good time, it sounds like.
He was having a great time. He's a young man. He's living in a... And Alexander was the sort of general who did not mind marching with the troops. If a donkey got stuck in a mud hole, Alexander would be there along with all of the enlisted men pushing the donkey out. But it wasn't really that bad. He had good food. He had his friends with him. He would march hard during the day, and then every night they would set up the camp. He would have a party, a big feast, a festival. So he was enjoying himself, I think, immensely.
We have an email from Jason. He says he was curious about the specific sources for the more scandalous aspects of Alexander's relationship with Ptolemy and his other male counterparts. Was the nature of the homosexual practices involved more of a matter of dominance, or was it a kind of affectionate relationship we think about today? And of course, in this ancient world, homosexuality was more common and more open, or homosexual practices were. As you mentioned, Alexander's father, Philip II, was murdered by a scorned lover, although Philip was married and had sired a number of children with women. He also would take male lovers as well.
Sure. The trouble is, applying modern terms like homosexual, bisexual, and all doesn't really work in the ancient world, because they wouldn't have thought of it like that. They really probably would have, especially in Macedonia, considered it very normal for a man to have a relationship with other men, but of course to get married and have children too. They wouldn't have thought of that as strange. And so Alexander, we know from the start, was really not all that interested in women. His mother even hired a prostitute when he was a teenager to try to, you know, spark his interest. It didn't really work out. But Alexander was interested in women. He did fall in love. He did have a couple of children over the years. But he also had very close and very intimate relationships with a number of men. And this was considered normal. It wasn't considered scandalous at all.
Right. So as the tales are told today, it may sound like scandal, but in those circumstances, in that world, it was not considered to be that way.
Oh, no, not at all. It would have been very normal.
Let's talk about, as the campaign went on, the Persian king, Darius, was the man who Alexander was leading his armies against, although he had not come face to face with him. But they do meet.
They do, and they meet the next year at a place called Issus, which is on the border of Turkey and Syria, down at the northeast corner of the Mediterranean. And it's really funny because Darius had this enormous army, and he is on one side of the mountain waiting for Alexander, and Alexander's on the other side waiting for him. And it turns into a mass confusion because Darius goes around the mountain looking for Alexander. Alexander crosses forward, so it ends up with the army of Darius behind Alexander, and neither king knows what's going on. And so Darius's huge army ends up in this difficult position of being in a narrow valley where they really can't use their numbers to the greatest effect. And Alexander jumps on this, and he takes advantage of it, launches his soldiers against the Persian army, and he beats them by using the same audacity of rushing fast, of using all sorts of different tactics against them. And Darius is driven from the field. He's not stripped of his kingship or anything. This is just the first battle, but he's beaten, and nobody expected him to be beaten.
And Alexander takes his camp and encounters Darius's family there.
He does. And by the rules of ancient warfare, the family of Darius, his wife, his daughters, all belonged to Alexander. And most kings probably would have helped themselves and to the women. But Alexander treats them with great respect. Again, Alexander is a very diplomatic person. He knows how to use propaganda carefully. So he treats them very well.
We'll talk more about his campaign and his conquests in a moment. We're talking about Alexander the Great today. My guest is Philip Freeman. He's a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah and the author of a new biography of Alexander the Great. You're welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Philip Freeman. He's a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah, and he's also the author of a number of books. His most recent is Alexander the Great, a new biography of Alexander the Great. And you're welcome to join our conversation if you have questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Just before the break, we were talking about Alexander's tremendous victory at Issus, where he defeats the Persian king, Darius, although he does not kill him. Darius gets away, although Alexander pursued him for some time, but he takes over the camp. He is holding Darius's family hostage, although in a nice way, I guess as nice a way as you can hold hostages. And he continues on with his conquests. At that point, Alexander had won victory after victory. He had overcome tremendous odds. Did he have a goal of his campaign?
Well, people have been arguing about this for over 2,000 years, about just how far Alexander planned to go. Did he want to stop at Issus? Did he want to continue and conquer all the Mediterranean lands? Did he actually think that he could conquer the whole Persian Empire? Nobody really knows, but my feeling is that Alexander's ambitions were boundless, and that he certainly at least wanted to conquer all the Mediterranean lands of the Eastern Mediterranean, and probably, I think, go all the way to India.
So he continues with his campaign. What kind of shape is his army in at this point?
Well, his army has some money in their pockets now, which is really good. He starts being able to hire mercenary soldiers, so his army is you know, pretty decent size. They're happy. They're winning, and so they continue the march down the Mediterranean coast. They go to the city of Tyre, the ancient Phoenician city of Tyre, which is on an island about half a mile offshore. Alexander asks them if he can come sacrifice at the temple there. They say, no, sorry, can't do it. And Alexander gets very upset, spends about 6 months there, builds a causeway, just impossible thing to do, but he builds a causeway across to the island, which is, becomes a strip of land, which is still there. And he conquers Tyre. He marches down the coast.
That's another one of those moments where it really should have been the end of him. That should have been his great folly.
Oh, it should have been. People had besieged Tyre for 1,000 years before that, and nobody had ever been able to conquer it. And people of Tyre just laughed at Alexander when they saw what he was doing. Well, after about 3 or 4 months, they stopped laughing. And especially when Alexander broke down the walls of their city and killed all of the men, sold the women and children into slavery again.
he continues on his conquests. He does get injured, but he just seems to overcome obstacle after obstacle.
Oh, he does. He gets injured a number of times during his campaign. The whole 12-year campaign gets injured quite badly. He gets injured in the city of Gaza, in what's the Gaza Strip nowadays. And he marches then finally, after he beats the people of Gaza, after a long siege, he marches into Egypt.
I want to, there are so many battles we could talk about, but I don't want to run out of time today. So let's talk about when he meets the great king, Darius, again.
Yes. Well, he conquers Egypt and then heads back up through Syria and into the northern part of what's modern-day Iraq near the ancient city of Nineveh. He meets Darius at a place called Gaugamela, which is an enormous plain there in northern Mesopotamia. And the army of Darius is at least twice the size of Alexander. He's got elephants. It's the first time the people from the Greek world had ever seen elephants in battle. And Darius has chariots with sharp swords, like things on the wheels. There's no way that any reasonable person would think that he could beat King Darius. But Alexander, I didn't really need to draw a board to draw on to show you what he did, but it's a brilliant move where he goes around to the side of the army as fast as he can and then doubles back and splits it in half and rushes King Darius and almost gets him, almost throws a spear right through him. But Darius flees, leaves the field, and Alexander has now decisively beaten the Persian army.
And he continues on, though Darius's resources seem endless.
Yes. I mean, Alexander has conquered all of Mesopotamia, but he hasn't even really gotten to Persia proper yet, modern-day Iran. And so Darius continues the fight, continues the resistance, but he's lost a lot of his appeal to some of his generals. And so there's mumblings that maybe we need a new great king. Alexander heads down to Babylon, has a great time in the city of Babylon, gets even more money, goes down to Susa, gets even more money, and then heads to Persepolis, which is in the southern part of modern Iran, the capital of the Persian Empire, and takes it pretty much without a fight.
And this is the site of his final battle with Darius.
Yes. Well, what happens is he takes over Persepolis, burns it to the ground, and then chases Darius up near what's modern-day Tehran in northern Iran. And Darius has been betrayed by his generals. One of Alexander's men finds the king stabbed and dying in a cart. And Alexander wanted to capture him. He didn't want it to end like this. But Darius dies. But some of his generals continue the fight. They flee into Afghanistan and continue the war against Alexander.
And Alexander was terribly disappointed when Darius died.
Oh, he was. I mean, he wanted to have Darius hand over the kingdom to him, marry Darius's daughter, and then send Darius off someplace under guard for the rest of his life. But it was a disappointment because now somebody new, a general named Bessus, was claiming to be the new great king. So Alexander had to continue the war farther and farther east.
And things became very difficult. There was snow, there was cold, there was horrible terrain.
Oh, it was terrible. Alexander had torn through Turkey and Egypt and in Iraq and Iran, and now he runs into Afghanistan, like so many people have since, and it's just like hitting a wall. The tribes of Afghanistan strike against Alexander's army and then disappear into the mountains. And Alexander just can't beat these guys. It takes 2 or 3 years of savage warfare for Alexander to defeat the people of ancient Bactria, modern Afghanistan, and stretching all the way up into Uzbekistan.
And he's perhaps one of the only people who has succeeded in a land war.
Yeah, it's funny,
in Afghanistan.
You know, when we're talking about the Afghanistan war, you often hear that nobody has been able to conquer these people, even Alexander the Great. But Alexander the Great did. It's just it took him several years, and he had to use brutal tactics to do it.
And it cost him dearly.
Oh, it did. It was very difficult.
So he continues on, even after that. He continues on even into India.
He does. He goes into modern-day Pakistan. He crosses the Indus River. He has battles there, one against a king named Porus, where he's fighting Porus, who's on top of an elephant. And he gets all the way into what's the modern Punjab in modern-day India, and his men force him to turn back. Alexander wants to keep going down the Ganges River, maybe all the way to China, but his men say, this is enough, we have gone too far. And so they force Alexander to stop and to head back, and he very reluctantly agrees.
He has conquered all of this land. He has won all of these battles. How can he, you know, being on the battlefield, on his conquest, how can he rule this territory?
Well, you hear about Alexander the General a lot, but you really don't hear much about Alexander the Administrator. He was a very good administrator. So even when he's on the banks of the Indus River, he has messengers going back and forth to his governors, all the way back to Macedonia, to Egypt. And so Alexander knows what's going on everywhere in his empire. He makes very good use of the Persian road system, Persian messenger system. So he knows what's going on. And he's constantly appointing new governors, removing ones that are corrupt. So he's really quite a good administrator.
Let's talk a little bit about his personal life at this time, because he does find time to fall in love. He finds time to have relationships. What is his personal life like?
Well, he meets in Afghanistan a man who has a beautiful daughter named Roxanne. And for whatever reason, Alexander says, wow, this is the one. And so he marries her, and they end up having a son not too long after that. But it doesn't mean he abandons his relationship with males. He just adds a wife to the mix. And so he's finally settling down. He's about 30, 31 now. And he decides, I really do need to have a son. And so he does. He gets married.
So here he is. He's in his early 30s. He has conquered the ancient world, basically. He's conquered Persia. He's still continuing his conquests. What brings an end to this?
Well, Alexander makes it back to the city of Babylon. He marches his army through the hellish deserts of southern Iran and loses a lot of them, but he makes it back to Babylon. And he's there one day, and it's the summer, and he's 32 years old, going to turn 33 pretty soon, and he falls ill. And some people ever since have said, well, he's poisoned. But I tend to think it probably was a combination of all of the injuries he's had over the years, plus some disease, maybe malaria, maybe typhoid. I don't really know. But he dies. He gets very sick, and he calls all of his generals to him, and they say, Alexander, who is going to rule your kingdom? Your son is just a baby. To whom do you leave your kingdom? And he whispers with his last ounce of breath, to the strongest. And then he dies. And so all of the generals, of course, think, to the strongest, well, that's me. And so they start to fight over his kingdom.
What happens then to this kingdom, which there's nothing to tie it together?
No, there's really not. Alexander hadn't had enough time, really, to establish it. So it splits into different pieces. Alexander's generals divided up. His boyhood friend Ptolemy decides to take Egypt. And Ptolemy founds a line of rulers that exists for a couple of centuries, all the way to the famous Queen Cleopatra was a descendant of Ptolemy. And so it splits up into different pieces. But what Alexander established as far as spreading Greek culture throughout the empire, that stays. And there are Greek kingdoms in Afghanistan for a couple of centuries after this.
So you believe that had Alexander the Great not gone on this remarkable journey, had he not conquered all of this land, that Greece and Greek culture would be just one of many cultures that we would be learning about today, not so dominant?
Yes, I think so. We'd still know about Plato and Socrates and everybody else, but it wouldn't have been that as big as a deal as it was. Alexander took Greek culture, and for whatever his motives were, and spread it all over his empire so that people began speaking Greek in Egypt, especially in the city of Alexandria. There are Greek speakers in Jerusalem, Persia, all over the place. You have Indian kings setting up inscriptions in Greek. And this lays the groundwork for a flowering of culture, of Hellenic or Hellenistic culture, all over Asia, all over Western Asia. And so it lays the groundwork for the spread of Christianity, for one thing.
How?
Because when Christianity comes along. Jesus of Nazareth is speaking Aramaic. Well, not many people speak Aramaic, but the earliest Christians write most of their documents in Greek. The Apostle Paul, when he's writing all of his letters to the people at Ephesus or wherever he writes them in Greek. And so Greek becomes the language all throughout the Mediterranean. Any educated Roman in Italy or Spain or wherever knew Greek, all really basically because of Alexander, because Alexander made it popular.
It's interesting to think how obviously that has dramatically influenced our culture today in the United States and cultures worldwide. It also makes me think about the things that we've missed. Alexander crushed a lot of cultures.
Oh, he did. I mean, he respected cultures, but he came through and he ended up killing an awful lot of people. And most of them recovered, but he certainly did have an impact on them, yes.
Philip, there have been many biographies written about Alexander the Great over the years, and he's been studied for centuries, his military tactics, his leadership, his strategy. Why did you feel the need to tell his story again?
Well, there have been a number of excellent books written on Alexander, but what I wanted to do was write the life of Alexander as a story for people who don't necessarily know a lot about the ancient world. I was impressed by a lot of the biographies of Alexander, but sometimes they assume a good bit of knowledge. And so I wanted to write something just for regular people. People who are fascinated by history like I am, but who don't necessarily know all of the details of hoplite warfare or whatever. So that's what I wanted to do.
Well, it's a remarkable adventure story that Alexander lived. For people who haven't studied the classics and aren't going to spend a lot of time thinking about this period of time, what one thing would you like people to know about Alexander the Great and how he touches us today?
Well, what impressed me the most in writing this book was that Alexander was absolutely relentless. He was one of those people who could not stand to lose. And because of that, he dared to do things that no sane person would dare to do, and he won. And because he won, his influence, his culture, the spread...
Oh, dear. We seem to have just lost our phone line with Philip here with with just moments today. We'll try to get him back on the line so he can give us his wrap up there. I'm talking today with Philip Freeman, who is the author of the new biography of Alexander the Great. Philip Freeman has written a number of other books, including one about Julius Caesar and about St. Patrick of Ireland. He is the Qualley Professor of Classics at Luther College in Decorah. And as I mentioned, we are hoping to get him back on the line. It's terrible, terrible to lose someone right at the climax of a conversation. So I hope that we can bring him back for you again. Again, the book is called Alexander the Great, and it is by Philip Freeman. It was just released recently. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'll tell you all right, we've got him back.
Yes.
Hello. Right. Okay. So now we have just a minute left. What do you want people to know?
I want people to know that Alexander was a man who just couldn't be beaten. And I'm going to switch phones here just a second. Well, maybe I won't. But anyway, that Alexander was never gave up, and because of that, he spread culture throughout the ancient world.
And for people who want to take a lesson from what he did and from his campaigns, I mean, we've talked about the war in Afghanistan and how difficult it is to fight a war there. What lesson can we take from him?
I guess the lesson would be never give up, because Alexander certainly never did.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Philip Freeman, the author of Alexander the Great, a classics professor at Luther College in Decorah. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Brian Dow. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with Ed Helms. He's the star of the new movie Cedar Rapids. We'll also talk with the screenwriter and producer behind the film. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.